Hello, my name is Paul Kearney. I'm Professor of Politics and Public Policy. And this is a series of short podcasts accompanied by a series of blog posts, which introduce key public policy concepts and theories in 1,000 words. This one is on complexity theory and complex systems. So it's worth listening to the podcasts on punctuated equilibrium and on evolution. Now, often, if you start reading up on complexity theory in any discipline, its advocates describe it as, exciting. It's a new paradigm. It's anti-reductionist, anti-positivist, relatively interdisciplinary. And on that final point, people say, well, you can apply the same basic ideas to the study of an incredible range of things. The unpredictability of the weather, the swarming behaviour of bees, ants anting, emergent thoughts in the brain, emergent properties in IT, and properties of social and political systems. But for me, I don't think you need this build-up to decide that complexity theory is useful. And in fact, for me, it's often the opposite. Part of its value is that it helps us bring together a range of concepts that we already know about. So in that sense, really, it provides you with a way of thinking in which you zoom out, zoom in to view individual action, or you zoom out to view that action within the context of a system or systemic patterns of behaviour. And it allows us to consider or identify key properties of policymaking. Now, to do that in this case, you say all complex systems have common properties. So let's outline those properties and then relate them to what we know already. So I'd say, look out for, there are dozens of different ways in which you can describe these properties or put them together. So bear that in mind. I'm going to give you five, but they won't be the same five that you see in all studies. But point one, a complex system is greater than the sum of its parts because those parts are interdependent. Its elements interact with each other, share information and combine to produce systemic behaviour. So, for example, it's not just the people in a system, it's how they interact with each other that produce behaviour. Second point, some inputs of energy into complex systems are dampened, and we call that negative feedback, while others are amplified, and we call that positive feedback. So small actions can have large effects, and large actions can have small effects. It's not always that easy to predict what they'll be. Third, we say that complex systems are particularly sensitive to initial conditions that produce a long-term momentum or path dependence. Four, you see complex systems exhibit emergence or behaviour that results from the interaction between elements at a local level rather than central direction. Fifth, they may contain so-called strange attractors or demonstrate extended regularities of behaviour which might be interrupted by short bursts of change. Now, those five basic properties exist in all of these systems that I talked about. So as you'd imagine, if this is a theory of almost everything, the language is quite vague and it's not obvious how you relate that to political systems. But what complexity theories in public policy and public administration seek to do more than other theorists, I think, is to apply this to a sense of giving good advice based on these properties. So here are some examples from some of the literature. In complex systems, law-like or general laws of behaviour are difficult to identify. So a policy that was successful in one context may not have the same effect in another. Then you might say, because you're talking about a complex system, they're difficult to control, and policymakers should not be surprised when their interventions do not have the desired effect. Another point made particularly in the UK is that governments have been too driven by the idea of order, maintaining hierarchies and top-down, centrally driven policies. And this includes attachment to performance indicators, ways to monitor and control local actors. And a lot of complexity theorists suggest that this just results in policy failure and demoralised policymakers. The final piece of advice is that if complex systems or their environments change quickly, then organisations need to be in a position to adapt quickly and not rely on a single policy strategy. So as I say, in that kind of context, there's a tendency in a lot of the literature to encourage the delegation of decision-making to local actors. So they would say, rely less on central government-driven targets, give localizations more freedom to learn and adapt to their changing environment, encourage trial and error projects or pilots that can provide lessons that can be adopted or rejected quickly. Get rid of the idea of failure, treat unexpected outcomes as errors or sources of learning, and then set more realistic parameters for success or failure. And then encourage a greater understanding within the public sector of the implications of complex systems and what it means when we talk about emergence or things like feedback loops. So in other words, this literature, when applied to policymaking, is a little bit unusual because we're linking empirical statements to normative statements. This is how the policy process works, and this is what you should do about it. So in that sense, this is relatively new, quite unusual. But in that kind of scientific sense, I would say this literature is really, for me, often the restatement of familiar arguments in policy studies. So I go into this in a separate post that I'll send you to on the 1,000 words blog post. And it says, imagine you're trying to translate these broad complex systems properties into an existing literature. Well, I think it relates quite strongly to it. So you've got, number one, you've got this idea of negative and positive feedback or feedback loops. So some inputs of energy are dampened, others are amplified. Now, I think that relates strongly to punctuated equilibrium and Jones and Baumgartner's work on information processing. Because you remember, what they talk about is if policymakers are subject to bounded rationality, they have a limited cognitive ability, limited ability to gather information. So they can only pay attention to a small fraction of the issues for which they're responsible. They have to ignore most, and they pay a disproportionate amount of attention to the ones that they place at the top of their agenda. So they receive the same amount of information, but they ignore most for long periods, that's negative feedback, and they pay disproportionate attention to some, that's positive feedback. Now, on top of that, that links also to this idea of, how much controlling capacity of the centre is there. Well, if they can only pay attention to particular issues, then that capacity is going to be relatively small. Then take this concept of strange attractors, so regularities of behaviour which may be interrupted by short bursts of change. Now, I think the idea is that it seems strange because if you have such an unpredictable political system, it seems to be notable that you have so many regular patterns of behaviour within it. Now, I think some of that can be related to the idea of positive and negative feedback, which extends to other parts of the political system. So, for example, central governments might roll out lots of instructions, but some are ignored by local actors, some are paid disproportionate attention. Okay. And again, that links to the role of central governments. They can only pay attention to adherence to their rules and certain parts of the system. Then you have sensitivity to initial conditions and path dependence. Now, that's a very strong feature of historical institutionalism, which I'll talk about in a different post. And in fact, if you look at key accounts, if you look at Paul Pearson's talk about historical institutionalism and Graham Rule's description of complexity, you've got the same reference to something like a polyurn, in which you have a notional bag in which there's a black ball and a red ball. And you put your hand in, take out one of the balls, and you have to replace it with two balls. Then that means that the next time you put your hand in, you're much more likely to choose that first colour of ball. And the point of that thought experiment is that you have a sort of semi-random choice that produces the likelihood of reinforcing that choice over time. So that's a sense of, you know, sensitivity to initial conditions and a sense of path dependence as you accumulate decisions and their effects. Now, that's the same discussion in complexity as it is in historical institutionalism. Then you have this concept of emergence. Now, I think that might be the only term which is really distinctive in political studies, at least compared to the studies of other complex systems, because it talks, you know, we talk about emergence in the absence of central control, the absence of a central brain. Now, that doesn't apply in policy studies because there is a central brain, you know, the central government. So what we're talking about instead is emergent behaviour at local levels, despite attempts by central governments to control what's going on, the development of local rules. Now, that should resonate with quite a few studies, such as, you know, Lipsky's famous street-level bureaucrats, in which, you know, central governments provide a huge range of requirements and professionals can only fulfil some of them. So they do that, you know, they fulfil key priorities while maintaining a sense of professional morale. You know, they rely on their professional training to work out which targets, rules, laws, you know, funding requirements they have to adhere to. Then you have a similar discussion, I think, in literature on multi-level governance or governance, which often talks about how governments have responded to a perceived limited central control by trying to reinforce the control with, you know, new public management and performance management, you know, performance indicators and such like. And there's a key thread within that governance literature that governments often exacerbate problems of central control when they try and solve them. Maybe most interestingly is that even that normative advice isn't new. In fact, you know, I think some people argue you don't really need complexity theory to make that recommendation. So it can take you right back to Charles Lindbaum and incrementalism in 1959. And there's this great section where he says, I quote, "Making policy is at best a very rough process. Neither social scientists nor politicians nor public administrators yet know enough about the social world to avoid repeated error in predicting the consequences of policy moves." So a wise policymaker expects that their policies will achieve only part of what they hope, and I'm paraphrasing now, and at the same time will produce unanticipated consequences. So they should proceed through a succession of incremental changes to avoid serious lasting mistakes. Now that to me sounds very much like the advice I talked about with complexity. So for me, its value is less about novelty and more about it's, you know, using it to bring together these insights from many existing studies. Okay, so where do we go from here? Now, there's an empirical and a normative direction. On the empirical side, I'll point you to this other post, which discusses in more depth the limitations to complexity, which might be solved by more applications, you know, empirical applications, and taking us beyond, you know, a sense that I pick up in which people are constantly reasserting its novelty without actually applying it empirically. Then there's a normative direction. Now, so I'll point you to a post which talks about the disconnect between this complexity advice and the constraints of political systems driven by elected governments, particularly in Westminster systems where there's an assumption of strong central control. And I've got a separate post on you know, the Westminster model. Now, in that sense, imagine given this... imagine an elected policymaker in the UK, a government minister, standing up to make a speech and saying, well, because we have complex policymaking systems, we can't control what happens, so we're going to delegate as much as possible. We're going to give responsibility to other actors to let, you know, to let them adapt to their circumstances. Now, that is very hard to justify when you're saying that you should hold governments to account through Parliament, you know, to the public through Parliament, because essentially that accountability requires the assumption that governments can be held to account and blamed because they're in control, because they're in charge. And it's very difficult to make the argument that they're not. It just doesn't seem to be very popular. Or, now this is the fascinating thing, governments, you know, the Scottish and UK governments, essentially present two different images of themselves, often almost at the same time. You know, one is, you know, we need to be pragmatic and share responsibility, encourage localism and, you know, the introduction of public bodies closer, you know, closer to users, or encourage service user-driven policy. And at the same time, they defend this Westminster model idea when they're seeking election or opposition parties are seeking to criticise governments. So that's, you know, that's a fascinating kind of sign-off there. This focus on complexity shows us this complete disconnect with the type of advice governments feel they should take and the ways in which they have to present themselves as, you know, in control. Okay, thank you.